Okay, very warm welcome everyone to the latest in our series of AMBS Original Thinking Podcasts. I'm Jim Pendrell, I'm Research Communications Lead here at the school. I'm delighted today that we're joined by an AMBS alumnus, Sean Marriott, who today is Chief Business and Commercial Officer at German biotechnology company BioNTech, which you may recall helped develop the first ever approved mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccine in partnership with Pfizer. Sean joined BioNTech in 2012, and prior to that, he worked in global, strategic, and regional marketing and sales roles at GlaxoSmithKline in the US and at Pfizer in Europe, before taking business development executive roles at Evotec and Lurantis. Now, during his career, Sean has successfully completed a number of complex licensing transactions with large pharma companies, as well as negotiated M&A transactions and raised finance from investors. Sean holds a BSc in biochemistry from King's College in London. As I mentioned, he's an alumnus here at AMBS, where he graduated with an MBA back in 1993, I do believe. In fact, he's previously told us that his experience at AMBS was crucial in his decision to pursue an international career. A year ago, he was also commended in the New Year's Honours List, becoming a Companion of the Order of St Michael and St George for his services to the development of the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, of course, although BioNTech is best known perhaps for its amazing work with the COVID vaccine, it also announced in only last month, actually, that it was now starting cancer vaccine trials in the UK later this year. And that's something we'll definitely be coming on to during this podcast. So I think, welcome, Sean. Welcome to Manchester. Now, the first question I really wanted to ask about was to tell us a little bit more about your career with BioNTech since 2012. Just tell us a little bit more about what you've been doing.
Well, I started as chief operating officer. There was myself and the scientific founder, and we ran the company. I did all the non-science stuff. That's what that role was. In those days, we had two businesses that we ran on a P&L basis to try and generate cash to support our research. And I was particularly involved in those two companies to make sure that we could optimize our cash flow. And then as we progressed our science, we decided to seek partners. We were a small German company. We wanted to become a global company, but we needed help on that, and we used the infrastructure of large pharmaceutical companies, but in order to access them, we had to license to them some of our technologies and some of our programs, and that's what we did. I did all that, and after I did that, I raised finance for the company. We're a family office finance company at that point when I arrived. A German family office and a small venture fund. Very long-term outlook, as you can imagine, with German investors. But we decided we wanted to internationalize, and I searched for finance, and quite successful actually in the US, where we raised some $270 million, which was at the time the sixth largest financing, so-called Series A, on record.
Why do you think you were so successful with the financing? You know, what was it? What was the offer that BioNTech had which made it attractive to investors?
I think it was the science. There are two things that investors look for in biotech, two main things. One is the scientific basis for the company, and the nature of the science, and the other is the management. And we published, I think at the time we'd have about 300 publications in scientific journals, five in Nature, and that gave investors confidence, together with the validation that we had obtained through these deals. I mean, we did five deals in 18 months, which raised about $500 million for the company in cash again. And investors saw that. And in fact, I remember one year an investor who came, visited, because we encouraged him to come and visit us. And I heard him on the phone to his partner saying, "You need to come and see this." And we'd spent 10 years pretty much building the company at that point.
Yeah. I mean, the point here is that it was no overnight success in 2020. You'd laid the groundwork for many years. In terms of the science,
yeah.
In terms of the funding, all these were kind of
that's
in place
right.
almost. Yeah.
That's right.
Which brings us neatly to 2020. And what I'm particularly interested here is, you know, the experience you faced from both a personal and a business perspective when the pandemic struck. Can you just tell us a little bit about what, you know, how the company responded in those first sort of,
yeah.
if you like, few weeks, months, and then the challenges that you had in terms of scaling up the technology?
Yeah. Well, from a personal perspective, I'd just done an IPO in the US, which it was a personal project of mine. So I was looking forward to a rest. And we did that in October 2019. And then the pandemic started, of course, in China in January 2020. And you're right. You know, we decided, I remember my colleague saying, it was the end of January, we were having a board meeting, and he said, "I think COVID-19 is going to be a problem for us here in Europe, and not only in Europe but globally, but we might be able to do something about it." And on that meeting we decided to turn the company on this program, and we had no idea if it was going to work. We had no idea how to manufacture it at scale, what the costs would be, whether governments would even pay a price that would allow us to make a profit. But we felt that sufficiently encouraged with the science that we'd seen in cancer to do this. We knew that we couldn't do it alone. If you were to supply a vaccine globally, you needed someone who could distribute for us and also help us at a global scale with clinical trials quickly. So we started a project, Lightspeed, we called it. And we had an existing partner, Pfizer, and we partnered with them to develop this together. And as with our previous collaborations, we went for a 50-50 profit sharing.
Had you ever actually planned for something like the pandemic in terms of actually being able to scale operations up very quickly? You know, was there sort of a template somewhere you had somewhere, or was it really just you had to just think really quick? But what I'm particularly interested here is, as a manager or your business management training, does that ever prepare you for what you had to sort of go through in terms of the challenges of managing that?
I think it really does. I think when you consider all of the things you need to do, whether it's discussing supply agreements with the government or figuring out what the cost of goods is for the vaccine, or indeed looking at CapEx requirements for scaling up, as well as just general management skills around motivating people to work what was extraordinarily long hours. I mean, it was 24 hours for a day for 11 months. I think all of that, all of the training that you had and I had at Manchester helped me. I really believe that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, were there particular parts of the training that sort of helped more than others?
Oh, without question, you know, the finance. I mean, you know, I mean, I can, before I came to Manchester, I really didn't. I couldn't figure out how people could say you could cost products differently, but the training I had at on the business school allowed me to really breeze through P&Ls and balance sheets, cash flows, and that's been extraordinarily useful. And I think also, you know, I work in a German company, I'm not German. When I was at business school, we were put into teams of five or six people from different nationalities, and it gave you a cultural understanding. I'd never worked with a Turkish guy before, and again, you know, just understanding that people have different cultures and different ways of doing things is important in international business. And I think that definitely helped me too. And then I think, you know, some of the more structural techniques that you learn in strategy and in how to break down a problem into its individual components and then generate options around those components, I think that too was something I learned and put into practice.
I mean, I was going to touch on that because the sheer number of different questions you had to sort of answer quickly, or challenges you faced, and how you actually break it up. As a someone trying to manage all this, that must have been almost the biggest challenge, actually, how to structure what you're doing alongside the scientific side, the innovation, you know, which we'll come on to as well. All happening at the same time.
You know? All happening at the same time. And I think what, you know, if I look back at that period in time, I think, you know, we just got on with it. And I think that's one of the things that I found with my company Beyond Tech is that we are very implementation orientated, and so I think, you know, the just the sheer scale of the task, we never considered it. We just felt that, you know, we had to do this for people.
And after sort of, was it autumn time of 2020? I'm trying to remember now when the first news came out of the success of those trials. And then you got governments starting knocking on your door saying, right, Mr. Marriott, can you help us, kind of thing. That must have been another dimension, the political dimension.
That's right. I mean, we've been in discussions with a number of governments already. In fact, in the UK, the previous investor who'd invested in a company I worked in, it was running the task force in the UK, and that was the first deal BioNTech and Pfizer did worldwide. And we did a number with the United States, with Europe, with Japan, before the results came out. And we were continuing to do that. I think when we got the results, which was on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock, remember that vividly. We'd already made provision for the fact that we were just at that point scaling up. The way it works in pharmaceuticals is you have to validate your manufacturing, because obviously with giving medicines to people, you have to absolutely ensure that, you know, what you give them, it was what it says on the packet, and not only that, that it's consistent quality every time. And so the regulators, like us, were having to do things in parallel. And the coming with the approval of a vaccine comes the approval of the manufacturing. So what we did was we manufactured at risk in advance without knowing the results, so that we could deliver some doses almost immediately once we have received approval, while scaling up.
So there were significant risks you were taking.
Oh, massive.
I'm underplaying. I mean, there were huge risks.
I'm not gonna lie. It was massive. But yeah. You know, I mean, I don't, at the time you take a calculated risk, and
can that be taught?
I think you can learn to take calculated risks. I really think you can learn that. Some of it is in the person, I would say. For me personally, I've always been a bit of a risk taker. I went into biotechnology companies where most of them fail, with the view that I kind of liked like the challenge and like the energy that you have with this. But I think you can partly learn it, yes.
Mm-hmm. What's coming across here is how nimble the company was in those days, if you like. I'm just wondering, fast forward to today, have the lessons you learned as a business, have you been able to keep quite a lot of those practices in the business in terms of, you know, being able to act very quickly? You know, has it changed the way you've structured the business in many ways?
I don't think so, no. I mean, I think we were always... We always wanted to move quickly, and whether you're writing a patent, I mean, you're never alone in the world. There's always competition, and whether you're writing a patent, you know you're in competition with someone, so you've got to be quick. Or whether you're doing a deal with a pharmaceutical company, you need do these things quickly. So I think this was just an extension of what we already did from a speed perspective, and we continue to do that today. I'd say it's one of our core cultural elements.
Which brings us neatly to today, and I mentioned in preamble about cancer and the fact that is an area which you were already looking at before pandemic struck, but actually now is an area of great focus within the business. Just tell us a bit about what you're doing right now, because there's lots of things you're doing, I know, as a company. Just tell us what you're doing.
Yeah, when I joined the company, our vision was really to bring personalised immunotherapies to the market, and it still remains that. What is a personalised immunotherapy? What the hell is that? It's really a recognition that if you look at two cancers molecularly, they are different. They have different sets of mutations. And so the immune system is designed to attack foreign bodies. And that's why we have an immune response against viruses and bacteria. But we also have it against cancer cells, because if you get a protein that mutates, is mutated, it becomes a non-self. It's not in the repertoire of what we all learn, our bodies all learned at the beginning of our lives, about what's good and what's bad in terms of threat. However, tumour cells themselves have become quite clever, and they figure out how to switch off the immune system, and all we're trying to do is switch it back on.
You make it sound simple, but yeah, of course, it's nothing but. But yeah, there's trials going on, I believe, here in the UK.
Yeah.
Just tell us about that.
Yeah. So, if I talk about, since we're in the UK, I'd talk about that particular collaboration. So, following Brexit, the UK was marketing itself as a flexible economy. And in health, which is a very big part of the innovation sphere within the United Kingdom, the government was really saying, you know, come do business with us, because we have the NHS and we have a very strong science base. And we took them up on that. And in January of this year, I came over and signed a deal to collaborate with the UK to bring what I just described, these individualised immunotherapies, whether it's a tailor-made product or something that's targeted to patients.
Mm. It must be terrific global interest in what you're doing now with cancer therapies, because in part perhaps because you've become so well-known as a company because of what happened in the last 3 years, but yeah, people now say, that's that company, that amazing things with COVID-19. Is that, you find that now internationally, investors, whatever it might be, governments, they know who you are, so it makes it a little bit easier for you to sort of say, yes, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if I go back over the last 10 years, I mean, we had very little awareness with investors or with pharmaceutical companies to start with. I mean, it wasn't, we had to do a lot of work to raise that awareness, and it was hard work.
Yeah.
But now I think it's a little bit easier.
Yeah. So no plans to rest then for a while for you. you never got your rest after the end of the IPO, and then you had the pandemic and this, I guess. But it sounds to me like you're thriving on the challenge that the company taking on, the challenges that the company's taking on.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've always got to, like, in my view, you can only do these type of things if you really have a fascination for the subject matter. And for us, that is the cancer, and beating it. It really is. And it's a tremendous motivation for all of us.
Just one final question on that. I mean, there's obviously efforts all over the world to tackle cancer, aren't there? And here in the UK, like elsewhere, many leading research institutes and just looking at this. How do you choose who to work with, if you like, when it comes to actually your own, as a company, what you're planning to do?
I think it's, there's a cultural fit that's important. Do we see things the same way? I mean, we are bringing, BioNTech stands for bio in new technology, so it's BIO and then NT for new technologies. And when we've been building the company, we've been focused on how can we develop technologies to address, in our case, cancer at the beginning, which can't be addressed with existing technologies. You need to have companies that take a certain risk with that, because you have to remember that up until fairly recently, there was no, if I take mRNA as an example, no one knew what mRNA was, apart from scientists. And there was certainly no validation with something being on the market. So you had to take a leap of faith in that. And we were searching for companies that took risks like we did and we do.
Well, just finally, because I'm conscious of our time's ending up on this podcast, but going back to the fact you were here 30 odd years ago, I think it was 30 years ago, if there's one piece of learning you took from that, which you think, yes, you know, that really has helped me the last few years, what would it be on the spot?
I mean, I keep coming back to the finance, because I really like the finance, and I like the financial models. Yeah. And it was pretty brutal, you know, because I knew nothing about accounting, nothing about Black and Scholes model, and we use them. We use all of the techniques, and when you're a small company, you don't have people to do it. You don't have experts. You do it yourself. And I don't think I could have achieved for the company some of the things I did without full understanding of that. Just even how investors think, you learn that, the theory of it at business school, and that's been extraordinarily helpful for me.
Super. Well, thanks, Sean. Thanks for your time today, and every success in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this episode insightful. For a list of our latest webinars, news, and useful business content, please visit ambs.ac.uk.